Middle East, Democracy, Morocco, World Cup, with VT Senior Editor Dr. Kevin Barrett, right here, right now, on
VT Radio. Let's go. With host Johnny Punish.
And we're on with VT Radio again. Dr. Kevin Barrett, welcome back. How's it going today, my friend?
It's going good, Johnny. We're getting pumped up for this Morocco game Morocco versus France. And by the time people see this, it'll probably be over.
Yeah, so, it's an incredible accomplishment by Morocco. I saw your newsletter about the Morocco team and your Morocco post. So I want to expand on that. But first of all, let's talk about the soccer team. How did they get there? Who are they?
Yeah, well, it looks like they're just a bunch of, you know, really good players. And, you know, none of them prior to this have been seen as superstars or great players. And they seem to specialize in defense. Now, I'm not really much of a soccer expert, as I wrote about in this new article I wrote about. Mm-hmm. You know, this is my chance to talk about Morocco. Everybody's right. Talking about Morocco. So here's my two cents.
Let's go with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not an expert, but I kind of, I watched the last couple of games and it's fun watching that the way they win. You know, they're beating these teams that are heavily favored, and these favored teams have superstars who are supposedly, you know, really good at scoring, but the Moroccan defense is totally impenetrable. And that's because they have a kind of what I wrote about. I've compared it to the rope-a-dope strategy that Ali used in his famous Rumble in the Jungle with Foreman, where they, you know, they let these really good, you know, offensive teams come in and just wail at them and, you know, control the ball 2/3 of the time and keep trying to score. But the Moroccan defense is so good that they never, you know, they get very few good shots. And, you know, by the will of Allah, the couple of good shots they get usually miss.
Well, it's incredible because this is the first African team to make it into the World Cup. So that's an incredible accomplishment. It's an advancement forward, I think. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's cool. It's, of course, that's the theme that the whole world is noting. You know, when I wrote my article, I didn't want it to be, you know, just another sort of, oh, hey, Morocco, the first African team, the first Arab team, the first Muslim team, yada, 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 because even the mainstream is going with that. Right. I did, of course, mention the Palestine part is worth talking about, of course.
Absolutely.
But I do think it's kind of cool how it is bringing people together. I mean, all of these groups are sort of on the same page cheering for Morocco. So it's a kind of a great atmosphere in the stadium where it's like a home game for the Moroccans. And it's kind of fun for me because, of course, that's my academic specialty and my wife is Moroccan. And so having everybody interested in Morocco, you know, having Morocco getting its 15 minutes of fame is kind of fun and gave me a chance to spout off in that article.
Well, you know, I want to talk about the politics of the Palestinian flag that they're using and the Moroccan politics as well in the Middle East. But before I do that, because by the time we air this, which will be either late tonight or early tomorrow morning, the game's going to be over. So I want to get your prediction. Is France or Morocco is going to win this game?
Well, I'm predicting Morocco. But of course, it's like every Islamic scholar, when they finish a legal opinion, they sign off by saying, well, that's what the best thinkers I could find thought. And now that's what I thought, but okay. Ultimately, Allah knows best.
Well, we're fans of both France and Morocco as well, because my wife likes to travel to Paris as well. She loves it there.
Yeah, me too. I lived there for a year.
Yeah. Did you? Yeah, yeah. Love it there. She likes Mbappe, and he's such a great player. So, you know, you got the greatness of Mbappe. The guy is super fast, and so we'll see how the Moroccan defense can stop this guy. And if they could, they deserve it. And I'm going to say upset. I'm going to say Morocco wins 1-0. What do you say?
Okay. I'm with you.
Because yesterday Argentina won, I think it was 3-0 against Croatia. So they dominated. But I think it's time for the underdog to rise up and defeat the Goliath, you know, the champions, which is France, right? They won the last cup, right?
Yeah, yeah. This would be another maybe the best upset yet. So
yeah, that's it'd be incredible. So the game's going to start in what, a couple hours, I guess. I think it's
It starts at 1 p.m. Central, 2 p.m. Eastern, and it's so yeah, that's about 3 hours from now.
Definitely going to have it on. So you got your Moroccan food ready to go or what?
Yeah. We're going back to the incredible dish that we had after the victory over Spain, which and that worked because it brought the victory over Portugal. So we're going back to that. That's chicken. It's called a djaj mhamra, which is sour chicken. So what it is it's a chicken cooked with these pickled lemons that are like naturally fermented over 6 months in water and salt. Uh-huh. And they kind of melt in your mouth along with olives. And so this time, rather than just the standard olives, we managed to get a hold of the really good deli olives. So we kind of splurged on that. So yeah.
Now you called it Zhaj Hamra. Hamra would mean red and
sour
in Arabic.
In this case.
Sour. Yes. Okay. Oh, it's sour. Yeah. Okay. The Moroccan language in Arabic is slightly different than the Palestinian Arabic, as you probably know.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, a lot of Arabs say it isn't even Arabic. They don't know what are you saying? When I was in Morocco, I had studied standard Arabic, and I got to Morocco and I picked up some of the lingo, the Darija, first on the coast, and then in Oujda, the east side of Morocco, where it's very different from the main one on the coast. Right. And so I was mixing up all this stuff, and you know, I know French pretty well, so throwing in a little bit of French along with all that. Mm-hmm. People thought maybe I was like from Syria or Lebanon, because the way I was handling the Moroccan Arabic with mixing it up with other Arabic, somehow they figured I might be Arab, because I looked like, you know, like I could conceivably be one of the sort of whitish people from those places.
You could
But I never fooled anybody into thinking I was Moroccan.
Sure. You know, I always notice the difference in languages. Like, for example, in Palestinian, you'd say Halib. Maybe
Halib? You mean milk?
Yeah, milk. But in Egypt, I believe they say Leban.
Leban, yeah.
So there's difference.
And then Leban is like more like yogurt. Yeah. It's fermented in other places. Right. In Morocco, it's Halib. You have to swallow all the consonants.
Halib.
Yeah, you get to say all that. Yes. You say the ha, you say the la, but they just have to jam them together until they fuse and melt.
I hope I get to use it. I hope to be traveling there in the Middle East sometime around March. I hope to go to Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, and Lebanon. I have family in Lebanon to visit, and obviously the politics over there are pretty rough. So I look forward to broadcasting from Lebanon and see how that goes, you know?
Yeah, well, that'll be fun.
Yeah. I don't know if they're going to let me into Israel to visit family in Haifa. I don't know about that. We'll see, you know.
Yeah.
We'll see
if they let me in. I'm not even sure I want to go into Israel. I just have this goofy, you know, I'm even also like holding off on going on Hajj, you know, because I've been so brutal in my critiques of the Zionist regime and the Riyadh regime. And those guys, you know, some of them, they you know, they hold grudges and stuff. And so
they do.
We'll see. Yeah.
Well, look, let's be honest. They have a list. I mean, that's why I probably won't go. They got a list. And I'm probably on that list just for the fact that I'm associated.
Hopefully you're just on the list of don't let him in rather than let him in. And
Right. I think it's don't let him in. In your case, who knows, right? But
I think maybe they got the bone saws out for me in Saudi and God knows what in Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about the Moroccan politics now. The team is actually, the fans are holding up the Palestinian flag. People around the world are going, what's going on? They're Morocco. Why are they holding up the Palestinian flag? Can you explain to our listeners and viewers what that's about?
Well, yeah, of course. The people of the region pretty much unanimously don't believe that there is any such thing as Israel. It's called occupied Palestine. And you know, they're patient. It may take a while for things to go back to their natural state. But that's essentially what just about everybody, all the people think. However, the governments in the region have long been, you know, bribed and blackmailed and threatened and so on, and forced to accept a much more pro-Israel position than the people. And this is the exact opposite of what the Zionist propagandists have been saying. You know, all these years, the Zionist propagandists have been saying, oh, the people of the Middle East, they love us. It's just those evil Arab rulers who hate Israel. Well, the truth is the exact opposite. And we're seeing that now because, you know, we had these Abraham Accords pushed through where these regime, you know, figures who have, they don't represent the people in any way, shape or form. A couple of countries that were brought into going along with the so-called Abraham Accords, which, of course, is a terrible insult to the great prophet Ibrahim, alayhi salam.
Those accords were the ones that Trump pushed through? Is that what that was?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Trump gets credit for it. But, of course, the American deep state or national security state really transcends individual presidents. And so this was a kind of an extreme neocon push to give Bibi Netanyahu everything he wants. And so they roped a couple of these Arab countries into signing this normalization deal with Israel. But the people in the region are not, like, they don't accept that. They have nothing to do with that. So at the World Cup, what we're seeing is that every time an Israeli journalist tries to ask a question, the response is, Israel, there's no such thing. You know, get out of here.
Right.
Go home to Palestine.
And
then the Moroccans are waving the Palestinian flag, as are lots and lots of other people at the World Cup. So it's a message that's stating that the people of the region are 100% behind the liberation of Palestine and the end of this bogus so-called state of Israel.
That's incredible. So let me ask you a hypothetical question. Let's say there was democracy in the Middle East, for example, in Saudi Arabia or in Syria, or Morocco is a king, right? Is that what's going on there?
Yeah, Morocco has a monarchy. It's a somewhat constitutional monarchy, but maybe a little less constitutional than the UK, for instance.
Okay. But let's say we had a democracy in the general Middle East. Would they be voting out these you know, presidents who are now rulers? What would it look like for the Middle East today
if we had? Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, the Arab Spring was predicated on this idea that there's a democratic upsurge in the region that ultimately cannot be stopped. And the thing is, I think it was kind of co-opted from the get-go. That is, that the aspirations for some kind of at least more representative government, whether it's, you know, what the West thinks of as democracy, which of course really isn't very democratic, it's more of an oligarchy, or whatever it is, that the people of the region are ignored. And of course, you know, first example of that is the regime leaders normalizing with the Zionists when nobody wants that to happen. So the Arab Spring then had these CIA experts in co-opting, you know, these kinds of democratic movements move in there and, you know, get the lists of the people on Twitter and you know, train people to do their bidding and, you know, organize and try and take over this popular movement. And so the Arab Spring was, I think, designed to fail as it did fail. It was designed to, you know, maybe, it, you know, if it ever changed a regime like it did, let's say, in Tunisia, the purpose of it was to change that regime in such a way that it was okay for the banksters who rule the West. So this wasn't real democracy. And so if we ever had a situation where the people of the region were able to kind of get what they want in terms of the majority of the people, it would probably be something that would have, you know, elements of what we've seen in Islamic Iran, in Turkey, which is still, of course, NATO occupied, but has become more Islamic and a bit more representative of the majority of its people. And maybe a little bit more like, you know, when Mohamed Morsi won. I mean, Morsi legitimately won in Egypt and was overthrown by forces that represented a small minority of Egyptians. Now, that small minority of Egyptians is basically the rich secular people who dominate the media with the help of, let's face it, Zionist Jews. So I think what you would, if you had an honest democracy where people were reasonably well informed, of course, and it's not a democracy unless they're reasonably well informed, you would have leaders who would be forced to pursue a long-term strategy to liberate Palestine, among other things. They would be supporting the interests of the people in the region in ways that in the past some dictators did, like Gaddafi and Saddam, in terms of using oil money to help the people and build infrastructure and education and things like that. And then you would have more Islamic governments, because the majority of people in these regions, especially the less educated people, are clearly on the side of traditional Islam, which does not separate religion from state. So you would have some form of officially Islamic social organization. And you certainly wouldn't be allowing any LGBTQ. You wouldn't be allowing the Muslim majority of the population to be drinking alcohol. That would be just as illegal as heroin is in the West, and it should be. It's more dangerous than heroin. So you'd have a somewhat different situation. You certainly wouldn't have the kinds of colonial exploitation that, you know, we have in a lot of these places where the Western powers will just move in and grab the resources and the local people don't, you know, only the elite gets the benefit of that.
You know, we've had over 100 years of colonial exploitation of the Middle East since the since World War I, right? So since the Ottoman Empire fell, of course they found oil in Iran, and it's been exploited ever since. Where are we going with this? I mean, you know, we have 300 million Arabs who don't live in freedom. They live in monarchies. They live in places where these super rich people are controlling their interests, and they don't have a say much in their government life, so to speak. Where are we going in the next 10, 20 years with this? Is it just going to end up into a clash, or are we just going to have the same old?
You know, I don't know where we're going. I mean, one thing I didn't just mention, though, is the kind of the simplistic sort of obvious, you know, simplistic answer to your question of what would happen if suddenly there were immediately democracy is right. all these countries would disappear and it would become one big Islamic state. That's polls have showed that about 2/3 of the people of these Muslim majority countries would like to be part of a unified Muslim ummah, and that that's their first loyalty, you know, more so than their current nation state. So
would that be similar to the Ottoman Empire model?
Yeah. Basically, it would be, you know, except that probably these people would have different ideas about, you know, who should be the central authority in this new, call it, caliphate. I think that's actually how it was phrased in the question. This was I think Scripps asked this question like 12 years ago or something and got that 2/3 figure. So from my perspective, that would be great. That would be the obvious solution. And however, it would have to be done right. And there are very powerful forces in the world that want to make sure that it's not done right. If it were done right, what you would get would be a sort of a federalist arrangement where local countries or regions would have a certain amount of say over local matters. But you would have the most important things would be you'd have a single unified defense, which, of course, Israel would be no match for. And that would be the end of the occupation of Palestine. And then you would also have an approach to the currency that would essentially be trying to eliminate usury. And so you'd have to support commodity currencies. So all that entire part of the world would have to accept only gold and silver in return for its oil. And it would quickly build up, all of the gold and silver in the world, or most of it, would go into that region then. And then it would be in a position to dictate the new global currency, which of course would be metallic or commodity based, gold and silver. And it would be, so it wouldn't be this creating funny money out of nothing at interest, the usury currency that the Jewish Zionist bankster cabal has foisted on the world through the U.S. Federal Reserve and so on, the central banking system at the BIS in Switzerland. All of that would go, and you'd end up with a non-usury commodity currency whose center of gravity would be the Islamic world. Now, guess what? The Rothschilds and their friends, this is their worst nightmare. So that's why we've had this war on Islam throughout all this period, is, I think, above all, to make sure that the people of that region don't get what they want.
Right. And of course, oil, right? I mean, let's talk about oil, because with oil, the West is always going to be there. I mean, that's just a fact. They need the oil, right?
Until they get chased out, you know. Same thing with Russia. Russia has oil and gas and all sorts of stuff. And so they've built up a military to defend themselves. And right now they are defending themselves. And that's what that's really about. And the Arab Islamic world needs to do the same thing. And it should have a long time ago. And it just hasn't been capable of creating enough of a military deterrent. From their perspective, you know, if we set aside the religious proscriptions, the best thing that could possibly happen would be for these countries to get a nuclear deterrent so that they could basically force the West to stop exploiting them. And then things would move towards what I described, a super Islamic state that would end up dominating the world through its control of a gold and silver based non-usury currency. And to my mind, that's how the world should be. And that's kind of how it was for a long time. Actually, the Islamic world was the center of gravity of the entire world. And the reason was that people trusted it. It had that the Muslims were, by and large, honest. The Muslim merchants and traders who traveled on the Silk Road were honest. There was a unified currency, unified weights and measures. And that basic honesty is what held the world together, the honesty that came into the world through the Islamic revelation. And I think that would be a great thing to revive. Of course, we have to understand it before we revive it. And I'm not even sure, you know, people in, the Islamic scholars even have quite figured this out.
Now, during the Ottoman Empire, if you were Christian or Jewish, you were accepted as part of the empire. You had roles in government. They weren't generally oppressive towards other religions. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. During the Ottoman period, all sorts of Europeans fled to the Ottoman lands to escape religious persecution. All sorts of different Christians did that because they were protected and allowed to practice their faith in the Ottoman lands while they were persecuted, sometimes exterminated in the West. And likewise, the Jews, of course. The Jews did much better in the Ottoman lands and sometimes had to flee there. The Islamic system is, it's not the, you know, as an organized sort of political system, it's not about forcing everybody to accept all of the tenets of Islam. It's more about coordinating a system of all sorts of different religions and groups working together, but basically autonomous in their own right. So that's why in the Islamic world, like here in the United States, if you're from a place that uses poppies, or smokes opium, let's say, you can't just come to the United States and say, well, hey, I'm from a different group, and for us, opium is okay, or, you know, coca leaves are okay, so I'm going to use my drug of choice. Because we write in the United States, one standard is imposed on the entire population. It's supposed to be a totally, you know, one unified system. In the Islamic lands, historically, like the Ottoman Empire, there were different rules. You know, the Christians could drink wine. It's fine. Drink alcohol. That's your thing. You're Christian, right? So the taboo on alcohol, or the criminal taboo on alcohol, would only apply to Muslims. And so the Islam is about allowing each group its autonomy to set its own rules. And that's one reason, among many, that it becomes sort of the obvious solution as a political system, because it's both plugged in to the sacred. It has a sacred set of narratives and symbols behind it, but it also has this built-in safeguard that's all about protecting diversity, protecting all of these other different religious groups.
Now, I'm going to ask you another question about your background, because on your newsletter, and by the way, I want to talk to everybody about your newsletter. If you're listening out there, make sure you join Kevin's newsletter and become a member of his. Go ahead and tell us about how to become a member of what you're doing there.
I'm not exactly handing out membership cards and anything, but you can sort of be an honorary truth jihadi you can read my stuff at my Substack. You can join and help support this independent work I do, which doesn't attract, you know, a lot of, you know, Soros type billionaires or government funders or anything like that. So Substack is kevinbarrett.substack.com.
Okay. Well, let's make sure, please support Kevin's work, because you know, doing this kind of stuff and getting the word out is with a little support helps us out a lot. So same thing here at VT Radio. But let me go back to what we're talking about, Kevin, about the Moroccan thing. You're a Moroccan expert, not in soccer, but you're a Moroccan expert in.
Well, my dissertation compared miracle stories, the Karamat al-Awliya, the medieval saints legends built around the miracles worked by the saints, with contemporary personal experience narratives of people who've had miraculous experiences. And I was interested in sort of how people tell these stories and how the stories themselves actually sort of mimic in their sort of structure and rhythm the actual experience. And then I tie that into how the structure and rhythm of Quranic language actually induces a kind of a trance state, which is associated with psychic phenomena, if you're approaching this from a scientific standpoint, or miracles and mystical or visionary states, if you're approaching it from a religious standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Now, so another question for you. You were born where? You're an American, right?
Yeah, I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, which is an hour down the road from where I am now.
Gotcha. So I'm fascinated. What does an American from Madison, Wisconsin, how do you get from there? You know, cheesehead, right? You're a cheesehead, right? Is that what it is? You know, somewhere like that, right?
Wisconsin, right? I don't own one of those hats, though. So.
Okay. But how do you get from there to Moroccan expert and speaking Arabic in Paris?
Slim Pickens on the missile heading for Moscow.
There you go. So tell us, how did that journey happen for you? Where did you go? How did you get there?
Well, I've been searching for truth my whole life, and I had some sort of spiritual experiences when I was a teenager, you know, and so I've known that, and then I also woke up to the problem with the JFK assassination when I was a teenager. So all of those things kind of set me outside the mainstream of American thought, and so I just kept on searching for truth and wound up with Islam as kind of the best heuristic way of stating the eternal truths within a monotheistic framework, and the best preserved sort of set of, you know, symbols and rituals and traditions that are tied into that. So, I also found this partly through people like René Guénon, the founder of the traditionalist school of thought, which largely rejects modernity And, you know, it's a corrective, at the very least, it's a corrective to this worship of progress that we've all, and technology that we've all been inculcated in. So after I read Genome, it kind of, you know, disabused me of whatever worship of progress and technology and, you know, this kind of secularist grand narrative that's become the central tenet of a de facto religion of this culture. And so that's, it's ultimately the short answer then, it's just my search for truth took me to where I am.
Interesting. Now, and then, of course, you lived in Morocco for, you said, about a year, I believe it was?
Yeah, I lived there for a year when I was researching my dissertation back in 1999 and 2000. And then I've also been there many other times and spent, you know, a couple of months here and a couple of weeks there.
Is that where you met your wife in Morocco or?
No, actually, I met her in New York City. She came over. She was the top scorer in the whole country on an English exam, which qualified her to come work at Disney World of all places.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. Moroccans, actually, a lot of young Moroccans, if they're sort of ambitious, they think they can, you know, they yearn to go experience the adventure of the broader world. And so my wife and, you know, a couple thousand other people who wanted to work at Disney World all took that exam and she got the top score. She ended up over in Orlando. And was kind of disappointed by what she found there. You know, that supposedly she thought she would be continuing her education. She had a college degree. She thought that, you know, they presented it as though it was some sort of graduate school, but it turned out it was kind of a, you know, Mickey Mouse school in customer service and things. You know, it wasn't terribly intellectual.
To get you into Disneyland, right?
Yeah, yeah. So when you graduate, they give you the mouse ears. You wear the mouse ears at the ceremony.
Well, okay. So now in Morocco, what's it like in Morocco to live there as an American living in Morocco?
I had a great time. It was a little stressful. And, you know, it took me a while to find my place because we started out in Rabat for a month and I didn't really know anybody there except people I could meet through the Fulbright contacts. And then we moved to Oujda, which is where Fatna is from, and lived in a pretty good sized, kind of traditional older house with one of those open courtyards, you know, open to the sunlight.
Beautiful.
With her family, or the extended family, her
and
parents.
I love that style, by the way. That style is amazing, by the way.
It's great. Yeah. 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 You know, the really high end ones become these ribats, they call them. You could go stay in a ribat in Morocco. And they're, yeah, it's wonderful architecture. The tiles are amazing. Now, this wasn't high end.
One of my big complaints about American architecture is, you know, they could use the old Victorian style, which is, you know, you have your formal living room and your formal dining room that in reality no one really uses at all. And so they waste that space. But in the Arab world, in Morocco, they have the, you know, the welcome room, right? You come in and you get welcomed. Mm-hmm. And if you graduate and you're a good guy and you're more closer to the family, then you pass the garden into the main house. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's the welcome room, which is pretty big. They call it the sala in Morocco.
Right.
It tends
right.
to be kind of long, rectangular, maybe benches on both sides. And those are the rooms that they use for the Sufi vicar mass meditation things. Yeah, where I stayed, of course, my in-laws were not doing that. But then I met the local Sufis and did some of that. After you get, you know, introduced to the family in the introduction room, the sala, and then right. you become friends with the family, then they invite right. you into where they actually hang out, right. which is, what do they call it? The kitchen, you know, what's the word for that? I can't remember. It's kind of like a living room / dining room. It's where they eat. You sit around a big table and you know, they feed you and unfortunately right. the TV is off and on, but that's okay for learning the language.
Right, right, right. And now in Morocco, the food's fantastic, right?
Oh yeah. It's, you know, even like the Incredible. Top French gourmets tend to recognize Morocco as one of the top couple of countries with the most interesting national cuisines.
Right.
And
right,
so,
right.
yeah, you can't talk about Morocco. And the cool thing about it is it's like all home-based. Like, it's not stuff that's based on gourmet restaurants. It's just it's a folkloric tradition where people, and primarily women, are just really, really good at right. this cuisine.
Right, right. Well, I'm gonna pivot right now to a couple of issues. One of the readers asked me to ask you, what did you think about the FTX fraud? This Sam Bankman-Fried, I guess this guy's name is. He just got arrested this morning or this week, and they're taking him to the United States to get prosecuted for massive fraud. They just wanted me to ask, what's your opinion about that and the crypto business in general?
Well, I wrote a piece about this a few weeks ago, and then Matthew Crawford, who has another really good Substack, highly recommended, came on my show to talk about this, and he wrote a more elaborate article about it. And his thesis, which I tend to agree with, is that it looks like FTX was deliberately created and blown up as part of a central bankster war on the crypto sector. So they're going to try to eliminate independent crypto and bring what's left in under their regulations. And they're going to say, look at what happened to FTX. That was unregulated. And now we have to go in there and take over. So I think that was probably it. He was just some patsy. I mean, he's like a drug addled, guy who was operating way above his Peter Principle sort of level of competence. Mm. His girlfriend seems Samantha or whatever her name was seemed a little smarter than him, but now they've arrested him. And so the question is, what's that about? And of course, the mainstream says, oh, yeah, because he's a fraudster. Well, yeah, of course he's a fraudster, but the arrest may have been timed to prevent him from testifying before Congress. Maybe they want to shut him up. They want to have him under lock and key where they can control what he reveals about what was really going on.
Well, what we're really talking about here is who controls money, right? I mean, it's very serious.
Yeah, it's a currency war. Yeah, and again, I really recommend Matthew Crawford's Substack. It's Matthew with only one T, M-A-T-H-E-W. Very smart guy. And he says it's a currency war between the current system, which is the petrodollar run by the Western central bankster cabal, versus a rising potential alternative from the East, which would be probably some BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, basket of currencies arrangement with some element of backing by commodities. And that, of course, would be a minor adjustment. Then the third wild card would be Bitcoin, according anyway to Matthew. And Bitcoin would have the advantage of not being controllable by and issuable by any central authority. And Matthew's one of these libertarian types who thinks that anytime you give anybody control to issue a currency, they're going to abuse it and it's going to become corrupt. So he's cheering for Bitcoin.
And what's your position on Bitcoin? Do you have one at all?
Do I have a Bitcoin? No, I wish I did.
Well, I have a little bit of Bitcoin, just a little bit.
I do have a little bit too, because I got a little bit of this tiny honorarium for hosting the 9/11 debates from my friend Rick. And it grew. So it went from being like totally nothing to being, inconsequential, but still something.
Right. Today it's around 18,000 US for a Bitcoin. So about 18,000.
Yeah.
It's up 10% in 3 days.
Yeah, it swings wildly, and Matthew thinks it's going up. He thinks that for two reasons. One, of course, is that whoever has the power to print a currency is going to devalue it. If you can just print dollars, toilet paper dollars, you're going to print way too many, and the value of the dollar is going to just keep sinking. Likewise, even if they do a BRICS currency, there'll be the same problem. So he thinks that people recognize that and prefer Bitcoin, which is limited in terms of how much can be printed, and no single source can print it. And then he also thinks that I don't understand really the technical parts of this argument, but he says that for large transactions or large currency swaps or whatever, big transactions, it's cheaper to use Bitcoin. So,
I love using it. It's fantastic for me.
Yeah. So if it's cheaper, people are going to use it. So it's going to keep going. He thinks it could take over the world. And so even the price increase that we've already seen could continue quite a bit.
Well, what I think in terms of what you said about this gentleman who got arrested, this young man with the fuzzy hair, the hippie guy, I guess I call him, or what's it?
Yeah, scam, FTX guy? Bankster fraud.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And I think you're on the right path there. I think that's what it is. It's a currency war. And I think they're going to regulate it. That's what's going on here. And we'll see what happens. See who takes control of the whole thing. Well, it's up in the air right now, So on that note, I want to say thank you for being on VT Radio again, Kevin. We're going to go ahead and I forgot to tell you, your mug's on the way. Not this mug. This is the Broncos mug again. I know it's the Broncos.
Wait a minute. That's not VT.
No. I ordered my own VT mug as well, and yours is on the way. It'll be there by Christmas. I'll get mine on Christmas, and so for the new year, we'll be flashing our VT cups. And I just want to let you know it's on the way. It should be at your house around the December 23rd. Okay.
Well, thank you, Johnny. Merry Christmas, and
Merry Christmas to you too.
God bless.
Okay, inshallah, right? Inshallah. Okay, have a great day, Kevin.
Yep, you too. Bye.
Okay. If you enjoyed this presentation, hit the like button now. Also, share it with your friends. And don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss an episode.
VT approves this message.